This is part two of a series, Why I Am a Christian. I wanted to do this because so many people come up to me and ask me, not in the context of sermonizing, but just my personal life, how I navigate through different issues, how I think about different things. I suppose not because I'm any more brilliant or different from you, but just because they see my face up here and they hear me talk about a lot of things. And so I thought I'd do a series. There'll be about 10 messages. Last week we started with, I think, the foundation of why I believe in absolute truth and the capacity to know truth and absolute morality. And this week, why I believe there is a God. That's not the same as next week's teaching, which is why I believe in the God of the Christian scriptures. All I'm talking about this morning is why I believe there is a God. And I want to start there. The brief text is Psalm 14, verse 1. Psalm 14, verse 1. By the way, if you're visiting, welcome. It's good to see you here. Make sure you go by the welcome desk in the lobby and pick up a gift bag. Just our way of showing appreciation for having you with us. There's bulletins there, all the programs, lots of them for the week. Psalm 14, 1, reading from the English Standard Version. To the choir master of David. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who does good. I've gone over this in my Christian ed class, but not so much here in the sanctuary. The first verse of Psalm 14 says something more and something different from what I think is frequently noticed. The psalmist, David, is not calling this man a fool for thinking there is no God in any evidence that he can find. That's not why the man is a fool. If you look at the words carefully, the psalmist calls this man a fool because this man tells himself there is no God when he really knows better. That's the real issue. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. In other words, the psalmist is critiquing the self-deception of this fool. The atheist, at least in the early stages of disbelief, the atheist is only playing dumb. He's only faking disbelief by inward rebellion. He's arguing with his own heart. The fool says in his heart, there is no God, there is no God. He has to keep telling himself that. We all do it in different areas. We pretend we don't know what we really know deep down inside. We learn it from an early age when, you know, little Johnny's in the kitchen with the chocolate syrup and he's squirting it all over the floor and Mom comes in and says, what are you doing? And Johnny's immediately in a dilemma. It seems perfectly obvious. Do I answer this fool? What do I... Johnny does the only thing that's possible in that situation. Nothing. I don't know. Well, he does know, but he can't afford, when Mom or Dad is standing there with that look on his or her face, he can't afford to admit the truth. The fool says in his heart, there's no God. There is no God. There is no God. There is no God. It's just what the atheist is doing with the most important issue of life. We know that's true not just from this little verse in the Psalms, but we know it from the rest of the clear teaching of Scripture. The Bible is absolutely clear that people do know on a gut level, they know the basic truth about the existence of God. All people. Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 20. If you have your Bibles, look these up with me. Romans 1, 18 through 20. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who by their unrighteousness, here it is, suppress the truth. There is no God. There is no God. There is no God. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, his eternal power, his divine nature, have been clearly perceived, not just revealed, that's one thing, have been clearly perceived. That has to do with our recognition, our cognition of what God has done. Ever since the creation of the world, in the things that have been made, so that they are without excuse. Notice the way Paul says this knowledge of God, quote, is plain to them. That's the argument the psalmist describes in that atheist's heart. There's something plain on the inside of the atheist that must be silenced, and he has to shout it down or whisper it down if God is to be ignored. You can do this, but it's not easy, because at least at first, I'm not talking farther down the road, at least at first, disbelief is not the natural condition of the heart when it comes to God. Rebellion is natural, but not unbelief. Atheism is at least in the early stages, a bit like a bodybuilder's physique. It can only be maintained through constant effort. There is no God. There is no God. There is no God. And the Apostle Paul tells us why this is so. He says God has so constructed two things. God has so constructed the world, and God has so constructed us in such a way that he is manifested both around us in creation and in us, in our own sense of morality that we looked at last week. That's in verse 20 of Romans 1. We read it. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. Read those words very carefully. Paul, exactly as the psalmist, is saying more than many people see at first glance. Paul's not criticizing disbelievers because they don't know about God but ought to. That's not it. He's criticizing disbelievers because they do know about God but pretend to themselves that they don't. His word is they suppress the truth. Just push it down. Now, this suppressed knowledge, and we talked about this on Sunday nights past when we're working our way through Romans, this suppressed knowledge, it isn't enough to save us. His invisible power, his attributes, but it is enough knowledge to awaken and alert us to the reality of God. And that sense of morality, that moral oughtness by which we judge actions of others and we know when we don't live up to it ourselves. It's in all of us. And responding to this universal evidence, can open up the door for more grace to be manifested. While incomplete in itself, it can lead to more light. To him who has, more will be given. To him who has not, even what he has will be taken away from him. And it is enough to condemn us, to establish our guilt before the God we knew and the God we rejected. Therefore, they are without excuse. Those aren't my words. That's what God's word says. They're without excuse. Let me quickly go through some of the basic arguments in my own mind, all right? If you have better ones, that's fine. For the existence of God, from the evidence of creation, both from our world and from ourselves. All right? First, I believe God exists because of the existence of the material universe all around me. That word material is the money word. However one chooses to do it, you simply must have some explanation for why there is something instead of nothing. Matter isn't eternal. Things have causes. No scientist alive has ever witnessed matter coming from non-matter. This is a material universe. How did it get here? Well, Pastor Don, the universe came here because of the Big Bang. It was billions of years ago. And so there is a cause for this universe. Where have you been? Let me suppose, just for a minute, that that theory is true. There are still too many questions needing answers. What banged? I mean, I know that seems trite, but let me just bring it home for a minute. I mean, none of us was around 7 billion years ago for the great cosmological Big Bang. But most of us have heard, at least on occasion, smaller bangs. I know I have. Imagine right while I'm preaching, you heard a huge explosion. Imagine it was the kind of thing where the pew you're sitting on actually started to shake a little bit. Maybe you saw a crack starting to form here. A number of things might happen. For sure, you would look around. Some would grab children and make for an exit. Some might wait for instructions, hoping ushers remember the emergency plan that they're all supposed to know inside out. But nobody would sit there like nothing happened. Something loud, deafening, shaking would make all of you go, what? Why would everybody react like that? Well, it's not complicated. Everyone would react somehow because we all know that small bangs and big bangs mean something. I mean, they don't just happen. A hot water tank explodes. The furnace blows. There's a natural gas explosion underground. We know that when you hear a really big bang, maybe two trucks collide on the freeway, and they're oil tankers, you're on the Queen Mary 2, and all of a sudden it comes grinding to a halt in the middle of the night. You don't just stay in bed. You get up and what? Did we hit something? Because the bang means something happened. And what's true of little bangs is true of big bangs, and it's true of the Big Bang. There just has to be something before the bang that caused it. And so the question remains, where did that pre-existing cause of that Big Bang come from? That's what the secularist and the materialist have to explain. Never think for a moment that all the evolutionist has to demonstrate to make his case is some proposal of the construction of some long extinct creature by the discovery of, you know how it works, part of a broken tooth under a mountain in Tibet. And they put the whole creature together and tell you what he ate and why he died and where he lived. Never think that that's the only chore of the evolutionist. That's hard enough, but that's not the task he faces. What the materialist has to explain is, why is there something rather than nothing? Always press for that explanation. It's never been explained by the greatest minds, the most prolific authors expounding evolution, including Richard Dawkins. They admit, I heard him in an interview, straight out, face to face, say, no one knows how life got here, and no one knows how this universe got here. All he knows is that it can't be God. Why? Listen, why can't it be God? Because there is no God. There is no God. Do you see it? But there's still more. Let's be gracious. Let's grant the existence of some form of matter. It was just there. Why quibble, Pastor Don? Who needs to know how it got there? Let's pretend our brains don't even pause to ask, where did this matter come from? Let's put that question aside. There's still a problem. Because, and this to me is a huge problem, we don't just live in a material world. We're part of that world, and we are self-conscious. We're a self-aware part of that material world. We don't just exist. We think. We self-examine. We know that we think. And that presents a huge problem. Consider these words from a great book, There Is a God, by the world's most prolific, one-time atheistic philosopher, author, Anthony Flew. He says this, in considering our immediate experience, let's perform a little thought test. Think for a minute of a marble table in front of you. You got it? Little marble table sitting in front of you. Do you think that, given a trillion years or infinite time, this table could suddenly or gradually become conscious, aware of its surroundings, aware of its identity, the way you are? The atheist position is that at some point in the history of this universe, the impossible and the inconceivable took place. Undifferentiated matter, and here we include energy, at some point just became alive. And then conscious, then conceptually proficient, then it became an I. But returning to our marble table, we see why this is simply laughable. The table has none of the properties of being conscious, and given infinite time, it cannot acquire such properties. Those are very simple and very wise words. Push the billions into trillions as far as you want to go back. Matter doesn't gain consciousness just with the passing of time. It's called the image of God. So Christians aren't the only ones claiming evolutionary theory has no explanation for matter, nor for life, especially self-conscious life. Point number two, I believe God exists because of the nature of the world all around me. It's related to that last point, but slightly different. Given that physical life exists quite literally on a knife edge of required conditions to sustain it. And we know that, right? Because the reason for the green movement is we're all aware that you just change the temperature of the earth a little bit and the polar ice caps start to melt and the ozone and all the things that happen. Everything has to be just right to sustain life on this planet. Given that that's the case, we of all people ought to know that the odds of a chance world coming into existence that prohibited life are much greater than the odds of a chance world coming into existence that promotes it. Look at the rest of our own small solar system. It's just a tiny little part. Most of the planets could never even come close to sustaining life. There are simply multiplied millions and billions of necessary conditions to make our existence on this earth possible. And yet here we are. We live in a world where life can exist, We just happen to live in a world where life can actually flourish. We live in a world in which mathematical laws can be discovered by scientists and physicists and they can be applied. We live in a world where a team of scientists, Christians, and atheists alike, they can work with observable laws and equations and do experiments that are repeatable, and the conclusions will be the same every time given the same conditions, and it makes for research and it makes for study. Yet the chances of this kind of world happening by pure, blind, random chance, they're pretty remote. They're pretty remote. True, that this all happened just by chance is technically possible. But the fact is that in situations of our daily lives, we would never, ever, ever accept those odds. Imagine you wake up one sunny Sunday morning. You shower, you brush your teeth, you've had your toast. You look out your window, holding your cup of coffee. There in your driveway is a 2009 BMW. You can't believe it. You run out, you look at it, sure enough, it's a real car, you sit in it, the plush leather, it's so much nicer than your little Toyota Corolla. The six-speed manual transmission, it's turbocharged. Naturally, you begin to ask around, how did the car get there? Is it really a gift? Who gave it to me? Now it is. I suppose, in some very, very remote mathematical percentage, it is possible that the car just happened in your driveway all by itself. I mean, perhaps atoms and electrons just came together randomly. All the parts just landed in the right place. The molecules required for rubber formed those low-profile tires. The glass formed the window, the metal formed the frame, the engine all came together with the latest enhancements and advances. It's all turbocharged. So, yeah. Technically, if you want to accept that, it might be, 10 to the nth degree mathematically possible for this just to happen. But not many people are going to quit phoning around thinking that the most likely explanation is that this car just happened to be in the driveway that Sunday morning so you could take it to church. The finer the design of the effect, the greater the creativity and intelligence of the designer. That's not complicated. If you found a stone in your driveway, you might assume it just happened, rolled in there. But if you find a BMW, it's not likely that it just happened. Suppose one of those exploration vehicles, you see them landing on Mars, and this little robot rolls out with his camera, and they're all investigating, looking for signs of life. They get all excited when they think there may have been ice here at one point. There may have been something else over here at one point. Maybe a volcano happened here or a crater hit here, and this is headline news. Let's push the envelope a little bit. Let's say the little machine lands on Mars after X number of years in flight, and everything works perfectly. The little robot rolls off. He's scooting around the surface of the Earth. Scientists are watching to see what pictures develop. They're nice and clear and crisp. And the sign there, Joe's Diner. Most people would say, that is pretty good evidence that there's somebody up there named Joe who's entrepreneurial and who built a diner. Would we draw the conclusion that all this just happened? Technically, it's possible. My guess is there's not a scientist on planet Earth who wouldn't say there's intelligent life on Mars, because I can see it in the design. Now, of course, there's no way from this distance that we could prove that it didn't happen by chance. But who among us would consider the chance explanation the very best one? So the design of this world speaks of a creator. If you believe that all of those things, the BMW in my driveway just happened by chance, and Al's diner on Mars just happened by chance, then all God's people should say, buy me a lottery ticket, because the odds are far better. 3, I believe God exists because we find ourselves in an inescapably moral universe. Now, this too is something we ought not to expect if the material universe was just a product of random time and chance. And it is, to my mind, the strongest argument for the existence of a personal moral creator. In other words, the moral nature of the universe tells me more than the material nature of the universe on its own. The material nature of the universe truly points to a creator, designer, but the moral nature of the world in which we live, it tells me something about the nature of the God who made us, what he is like. Mankind is unique among the rest of creation, living creation, in this one respect. He not only acts, but he judges his actions. He doesn't do things by instinct. He ponders what he does. He thinks about the significance, the meaning of what he does in a way the rest of the animal world doesn't. He judges his own actions. He judges the actions of others. Every day, around the world, in multiplied billions of different situations, in every culture on earth, people make moral judgments. We looked at this in last week's teaching. We not only judge individuals, but we judge whole cultures. Ruling out culture itself as being the ultimate source of our moral sense. We frequently make judgments against the opinion of the majority. Martyrdom still exists in the world. And this is the story of the whole of human existence. We often wrestle with what we ought to do in given situations. The point isn't that the right choice is always obvious. That's not what I'm saying. The right choice isn't always obvious. Nor is the point that we always do what we ought to do. Frequently we don't. The important point is that we wrestle with this moral sense at all. We can't seem to escape this sense of moral oughtness. We don't invent it. We don't seek it out. Sometimes we try to avoid it. Sometimes we try to ignore it. Sometimes we suppress the truth. But it takes force to do it. It takes force to do it. As one would expect, if we are created by a moral God, moral struggles just seem to seek us out, young and old. It's as though these moral realities were already present, waiting for us in the design of the world in which we live by its creator. Even when we make a wrong choice, what makes it wrong for us is that moral sense that we weren't doing the right thing. And the other important point is that this sense of morality, it's incredibly strong. We all know what we mean whenever we say, you know, I really ought to do such and such. I really ought to phone so and so. You know, I really ought to write a thank you card to. You know, I really ought to spend more time with my kids. You know, I really ought to start going to church Sunday night. You know, I really ought to, and there it comes. There's incredible power in that experience, and we need to think about it carefully. Because when you say, whatever it is, when you say, I really ought to do so and so, you don't just mean, and this is important, you don't just mean, it seems to be to my advantage to do such and such. Because sometimes what we ought to do doesn't feel like it's to our advantage at all, and yet we still feel we should do it. I really should include this on my income tax, even if it costs me. When we say I ought to do so and so, we also don't mean I think this is the simplest, most convenient thing to do. We don't even mean I prefer to do so and so. I know this might seem obvious, but we need to think deeply about it, because frequently what we know we ought to do is neither advantageous, nor is it pleasant, nor is it preferable. But there's still that moral nudge in our hearts, a moral magnet, an ethical imperative. It churns down deep in our beings. Where does that come from? I'm not arguing that it can't get all mixed up, it can't get all messed up, that some people have a mixed up sense of morality. That's not what I'm arguing about. I'm simply saying, however it works, it's there. And if we're just the product of chance and time, if all of us are just not long out of the trees, where did that come from? Who put that there? The Bible says it comes from being made in God's image. We don't just act. We measure our actions. We judge our actions. And that leads us to the last thing. Actually, this is the second last thing, just because sometimes people count when preachers say that. In that text, Psalm 14:1, to the choir master of David, the fool says in his heart, there is no God. They are corrupt. They do abominable deeds. There is none who is good. Notice what the psalmist says. Here's a person who keeps telling himself there is no God. He keeps whispering it to his own heart. He tries to comfort himself with that truth. There is no God. Paul says the same thing. Paul says he suppresses that truth. He just stifles it. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of moral energy, but he does it. He just keeps stifling it. Why? Well, the psalmist says because this person, this fool, says he's already committed his life to doing abominable deeds. And the existence of a moral God doesn't mesh well with a commitment to wickedness. And so you either have to abandon wickedness or you have to deny God. And there's the psalmist's dilemma and the choice he makes because he doesn't want to change his life. The choice he makes is to deny God. So that's why the fool has to play dumb. That's why he argues with his own heart. He can't afford to face the moral fingerprint of God on his life. Unbelievers don't just disbelieve, they reject. But let me close with this. Now I am closing. If this all seems, you sit and you think, man alive, Sunday morning, like, can't you go through John 3:16 or something? This is an awful lot of work, Pastor Don. Why would you be talking about this? If it seems like poor material for Sunday morning teaching in God's house, I want you to look back to that opening text one more time for a clue to the contrary. It comes in the verse, in the words that we actually don't even quote. We usually just leave them out because they seem insignificant. Most of the time we just start reading, the fool says in his heart there is no God. But the text actually starts before that. The text actually says, to the choir master of David, the fool says in his heart there is no God. David ponders this whole thing about the existence of God. And as he does, jots down a few thoughts, sends it down the hall to the worship pastor, says, you need to put some songs together around these ideas about the fool, about his denial of God, about where that comes from and why it matters. And make sure that on Sunday when we're singing and worshiping, when the people come into God's house and when they kneel before their Maker, make sure that we've got some stuff that makes them think about this when they're in church. Get the choir singing about it. Take out a hymn book and sing, Immortal, Invisible, Only Wise God. And make sure that the people have their lives built on something solid. So my argument would be that from the Bible itself, the commandment is, make sure these things are in your head. I know, truth has to be more than just in the head. It has to reach the heart. My experience is, it has to at least get into the head before it can reach the heart. You have to ponder it. You have to think about it. We're from God. We live through God. And we go to God.